In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I discuss SEO across multiple domains, charging before product market fit, and more listener questions. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 190. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. So where this week, sir?
MicroConf Europe is not yet sold out. So if you're interested in acquiring some tickets to that, you can get your tickets over at microconfeurope.com. Sign up for that mailing list. There will be some emails going out shortly. There's some advanced emails that have gone out so far. I believe next Tuesday, when this episode goes live, is when we'll start opening up the doors on that list. So definitely head on over if you're interested. Hopefully we'll see you there.
Come hang with us in Prague in late October. So hey, kind of a milestone for me today, drip email automation that we've been working on since January. We released it to an early access group. I think it was about a month ago. I mentioned it on the podcast when we did. But it launched to all of our customers, new and old, all new signups, everyone. As of just a few hours ago, everyone has access to it. So it feels pretty good to get that out. I recorded a bunch of screencasts because I found email automation is simple enough. It's a bunch of rules where you can move people in and out of lists. You can do stuff based on whether they click a link or whether they make a purchase or whether they do something else. They sign up for a trial or whatever. But there's so much more complexity to this that needs to be explained. So that's what I've spent the last several days doing. Before we announced it, I mean, the feature's been ready for, frankly, 3 or 4 weeks. We haven't made any changes to it since early access, except from adding new stuff. But I really wanted to get a couple case studies, and I have some blueprints for different rules that we're using internally, you know, on our SaaS apps, and that I'm seeing other people use with like ebook downloads, that it's having the idea of how to use this powerful tool rather than just saying, here's this powerful tool, go to use it, right? So that's what I really wanted to help folks kind of get on board with it. So we'll see how that pans out.
Neat. Well, in news on my end, I've got half a day left of consulting work, and then after that, I'll be on Audit Shark full time at that point. Around noon tomorrow, I will be a quote-unquote free man.
How does that feel?
A little disconcerting to kind of be back in that position, but you know, I'm looking forward to it. My schedule has backed off significantly, so I've been working kind of part-time, and I've been laying out like what my days look like working on it full-time so far. So it'll be an interesting change. I've definitely been splitting up my mornings and afternoons considerably more than I ever did when I was consulting. So
right. I remember when I kind of quit consulting that I suddenly had way more time than I knew what to do with, but I really had to convince myself to focus and to take that time and put it to good use, right, to move the product forward, because I was no longer forced into this artificial 2 or 3 hour a day thing that of evenings and weekends. And so I had to be more mindful of my time, but it was fantastic. I remember the day vividly, and I hope you celebrate. Go to a coffee shop.
I tried a coffee shop last Friday, and didn't go so well.
Didn't go well, yeah.
The issue was that they didn't have a place for me to plug my laptop in, so at around noon, I was almost out of battery power.
You can't do that. So we got an email with the subject line of music to get focused, and it was from Michael Koper, and he says, "Hey, Mike and Rob, love your podcast. I'm a new listener, and it helps me a lot with the creation of my first SaaS app." And he goes on to reference the when we talked about music to help getting you focused. And he says, "I found this iPhone web app called Noon Pacific, and it's noonpacific.com. Every week, they release a new playlist with 6 to 8 songs for free. The music is handpicked from different music blogs. The type of music really helps me to focus. It's very relaxing and not disturbing. You can loop on the playlist for the week over and over, and you can listen to other playlists. Hope it helps the others same as it helped me."
Yeah, speaking of sharing good news and tips, we've got an email from Rob Marsh who says, "Hi, Rob and Mike. Just wanted to drop you guys a line to say thanks for the podcast. It's definitely at the top of my listening list, and as a non-techie, I find much of the advice you guys give very useful. I found the podcast about the time I was asked by my corporate boss to downsize my entire division of 40 people. I was the last person on the termination list. Your podcast gave me ideas and information that made acquiring my first app much easier. That app, Logomaker.com, is an online logo design resource for people looking to start a business or prove a concept with a professional-looking but inexpensive logo design. Although I didn't build it, I've learned a lot as I've been trying to grow it over the past 2 years. This week, I'm launching my second site, logodesign.com, which has a different focus, helping designers connect with potential clients. Just want to say thanks for the ideas, information, and encouragement you give your listeners each week. You guys have been a great resource." So that email comes in to us from Rob Marsh. Keep up the good work, Rob, and let us know how things go.
So last update before we dive into some listener questions. Drip's growth is just starting to pick up to a point. Like, well, you know, I've been in that learning phase. Remember my MicroConf talk where I talked about building, learning, and scaling? We've been in the learning phase, trying to figure out what people need. Getting email automation out the door is a big step in that process. Probably not coincidentally, within the past 1 to 2 months, growth is just starting to creep up. So I can't tell yet if it's a blip, if it's a coincidence, but I have some aspirations, you know, some high hopes that A, it's going to continue, and B, now that automation is out, there'll be more of a compelling reason to keep people around. It's like trying to hit product market fit so that people come in, use the product, get a lot of value out of it, and then change their behavior, you know, and actually continue to stick with it. So I'll obviously update in future episodes as things go with that, but so far so good the last couple of months.
You know, there were some people on Twitter who were asking me about how things were going with Google because of Audit Shark's experience with the Panda update. And things have actually not only reverted back to normal, but they've actually been better than they were before.
Nice. See, that typically happens with sites that aren't doing anything, you know, gray hat or black hat, that when these updates come, the gray hat, black hat guys get booted, right? Or just get downgraded. And then the other, I say, more legitimate SEO sites are able to move up. So that's good news.
It is disconcerting in the fact that it happened at all, because it means that I'm kind of in that, I'm probably in that gray zone. So that means that I need to kind of revisit a lot of those pages and make sure that I move, I guess, into more of a legitimate territory than in Google's eyes, which kind of sucks because you don't necessarily know everything that they're looking at. I've been looking through the Moz collateral that they publish every year, basically kind of indicating what they believe that Google's algorithms are based on and how much weight each of those things carries. So I've been going through those and taking a look at them and trying to match them up with what I'm doing on some of those pages to make sure that hopefully this won't happen again.
Very cool. Well, let's dive into some listener questions today. We have several backed up and I want to cover them. Our first one comes from Jay Adams and he has two questions. He says, the first is, I received a different amount than what was invoiced to an enterprise customer overseas. It turns out that an intermediary bank charged a wire transfer fee. I have no way to track these fees and wondered how other startups are dealing with it.
Banks are just such a black box. I don't even know how they calculate some of the fees.
To be honest, I've never heard of like an intermediary bank charging a fee on it. And I would question the legality of that, because typically it's the sending bank and the receiving bank, right? And the sending bank will often charge a fee. It's like a $35 fee, $45 fee for an international wire transfer, depending on what country it goes to. The receiving bank sometimes has fees for receiving wires, and that's a whole other deal. But I've never heard of it like an in-between bank. I would personally call your bank and try to figure out how that happened, why it happened. There has to be a schedule of fees somewhere. That's how I would look to handle it. The way I've handled this in the past when I've had international contractors that I've had to do wire transfers to is if the payment is broken up over multiple payments, I will cover the wire transfer on one and then make the contractor cover it on another, or just split the fee 50-50. Sometimes I ask them to eat it. I mean, it kind of all depends. Not knowing the fee in advance is probably the more disconcerting part of this. Jay's second question is, he said it's an unrelated question, but he says, I currently have two websites, Noxygen.com for the main company site and SystemFrontier.com for the product landing page. I may offer a few other products in the future, but I really want to push my primary product's brand as well as simplify site management. I plan on relaunching the sites soon with a fresh new look and more content. Am I hurting my marketing and SEO efforts by having multiple sites?
I would say you're probably not hurting your marketing efforts. The thing I would wonder about is how related are these products that you're going to be launching? How much overlap is there between them? Could you do any sort of cross sells or upsells to people? Because if you're selling into similar markets, there is the potential that you could bundle it. And so if there are complementary features between the two products or any sort of integrations that you could build, and especially if you're going to go down the road of offering 3, 4, 5 different products and then bundle them together as a suite. If you look over at companies like Redgate, where they've got all these tools around databases, so they've got all these SQL Server tools, SQL developer tools, you know, .NET development tools, and they start bundling them together. I mean, you can buy any one of them for their lowest end one. I think at one point was $30, but most of them are anywhere from between $100 and $800 or $900. But then they start bundling them. And if you were to buy just one of the, you know, every single one of those products individually, it would cost you $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, but they bundle them together and it costs cost you $1,500 or $2,500 or something along those lines. So I would look at what you're doing and see if it kind of fits that model. And if so, then you probably want to have one site for everything where, you know, you have this hierarchy on the pages where you're doing all of your sales and marketing and trying to figure out on that main page whether people are interested in one thing or another and then kind of pushing them down the tree. But it really depends on what your outlook is for those future products and how much integration there is going to be. Now, in terms of being able to maintain them, it depends on whether or not you are going to be the one maintaining them. That might be something that I would, you know, maybe you put together the initial architecture for the site and then hand that off to somebody to actually implement a lot of those things, because implementing the look and feel can be extremely time consuming on an ongoing basis, especially if you're going to start changing a lot of that stuff.
My take on this would be you should have a product site. You don't need a company site since you already have one. I would tend to make that a thinner, smaller site and not have a bunch of product info on it, because then you're competing with yourself for search terms. And you really want the product site to rank for your main terms. So I do think that in terms of SEO, you're going to want to, you know, have more links pointing to your product site, because that's where people are going to go research it and buy it. Whereas if they come to your company site and see a bunch of products, it's just a much harder path for them to actually get to a purchase. With that said, I think there's some value in having a company site that does list all of your products. If you go to thenumagroup.com, you can see an example of that. I think WildBit has a similar website where they kind of list all their products and it gives you an idea of who's behind the company and what they're up to. I think there's value there, but that's not something that I would push a lot of traffic to. And I think if you're looking at having multiple products and you want to integrate or have upsells, you know, between them and bundle them, like Mike was saying, I think you do that on the individual product sites, that you still have System Frontier ranking well. When you introduce your second product, then you can have like a little sidebar on System Frontier. You can have a checkout option where it's an easy add-on, a checkbox to also get this other piece, and that you educate them on each of the individual product sites. You can also mention this on your company site, but again, the company site, in my opinion, is more about information rather than commerce, and each of the product sites are about product information with always a push towards the call to action of buying. So I hope that helps, Jay. Thanks for writing in. Our next question comes from Ben Perove, and he says, "Hey, Rob and Mike, I'm just curious to get your thoughts on the test-driven approach to development. Is it better to incorporate this principle into your project from an early stage, or is it more of a hindrance to progress? It seems there's a lot of pros and cons to consider. If you were starting a new project today, would you test or not test?" And for those who aren't aware of test-driven development or don't know what it is, it's if you're really going to be, you know, strict about it, you would actually write a test first before you write any application code. And you always start a new feature by writing a test, having it fail, then writing code. That's the strict adherence to it. But I know a lot of people who do quote-unquote TDD, and they don't actually write the test first. They just write a feature and then write a bunch of tests to, you know, kind of a test suite to test that feature before it's ever released into production.
That's how I do it. I will write the function and then make sure that it's working and then write a bunch of tests after the fact in order to test edge cases and make sure that it's working. And then when, you know, you have your build process kick off, it runs through all those tests and you can make sure that nothing else that you did broke anything core. It's a hard question to answer. I think that it depends a lot on the product and how much you're going to be involved in the development process, because I think that as you start outsourcing software development, those tests become more and more critical, especially for a lot of the core pieces, because you're going to have people in there and making changes that they don't necessarily understand why the architecture is the way that it is. And there may be some very, very subtle nuances to how it's put together that they're just not familiar with, or they don't know, or you know, maybe it was documented and they just didn't read that part or it didn't stick in their head. So there's advantages to that, but the downside is that it takes you extra time to put these tests in there. So it kind of depends on what, I guess, stage you are in terms of like customer development to figure out, are you actually solving the right problem? Because the worst thing in the world would be to go out, build the product, and have all these unit tests in there that are going to make sure that it's functioning correctly. But if you're not actually solving problems for the customer, then it doesn't really matter. You've written all this, not only have you written a product for nothing, but you've written all these extra tests for nothing as well. So I think it depends a lot on how sure you are of that market and your ability to sell into it. And as time marches on, you really want to make sure that you are putting some of those tests in place. I'm at the point right now where I'm actually looking to potentially hire somebody to just write unit tests, because there's a lot of, like, there's a there's some core libraries that I wrote that I have some unit tests in because I knew that those would not change. And then I kind of backed off from unit testing for a while. And now I'm at the point where I'm kind of revisiting it and going back to it. Maybe that's the right answer for my situation, but it may not necessarily be the right answer for your situation.
Yeah, I've written a lot of code without tests just because we didn't used to write tests, right? I mean, it wasn't until 2006-ish that I started really hearing about TDD and then started implementing it around 2007. It is a learning curve. Like, when you first start, it takes a long time just to figure out how to write tests, what to test. You become effective at it and you get faster at it the more you do it. It's a learned skill. And so that first uphill learning curve is pretty steep, but then you get better at it. I've heard estimates that it's around 20% additional development effort. So if a feature is going to take 10 hours, it'll probably take around 12 hours if you write tests. For me, I will never have another piece of software written without tests, especially not a SaaS app. We have full test suites literally in the thousands for Drip, and it has allowed us to make some major changes to the app without too much worry that things were going to go bad. And trying to go back now and write the Drip test suite would be an enormous amount of time. It would probably be a developer or two for a month. And I don't think that they would do as good a job as Derek did as he went through the code. Because, you know, when it's all fresh in your head, it's easier to write the test. With that said, I do agree with Mike that it could be viewed as premature optimization by some. If you're building a prototype, you're entering a really uncertain market, yeah, it can be faster to release software without tests. But for my money, anything I launch, I'm going to probably stick with it until it works. And if you're going to have multiple developers working on a project over time, if you're going to keep it around for multiple years, and if it's going to be a somewhat complex and critical app that you're going to make your living on, by my vote, I will never have another one that does not have a full test suite. And in fact, we're in the process, we're almost done rewriting Hittail in Rails. I mean, I'm going to be moving it over to Amazon EC2, so I don't have to deal with classic ASP anymore. And that was one of the reasons that I wanted to do that. One of the pros to it is that we have just a massive test suite now.
One of the other benefits of having that test suite as you write it, and this is kind of one of the clear benefits of test-driven development, is that when you start making changes in your own code, you can know whether or not you broke stuff in the core that you may not have tested fully. And I'll give you a very specific example from AutoShark, was when I was writing all of those unit tests, because the core of AutoShark uses this essentially a scripting language that I wrote, I test a lot of things in that scripting language to make sure that it still works. And there was one point where I was making some what I thought were relatively minor modifications to how the engine was operating to essentially make it more efficient. And I ran it through the test suite and it broke like 200 different things. And it was not obvious that it broke them. You know, it was this very, very small piece that I thought was just an edge case that I literally didn't even think too much about it. I was like, oh, I'll get to that. And then I forgot about it. And it was that edge case that nailed me. And there were a couple hundred of these things that just failed. And I wouldn't have noticed it unless I had that test suite, because I was doing some very small tests and saying, okay, does this work or does it not? And it does, but as soon as you start running it through all these edge cases, which test suites tend to exercise those edge cases and they'll do it a lot more efficiently than you ever will by hand, it will catch all those things. So it could have been almost disastrous had I kind of rolled that out and not really thought about it. I just threw it in there, and then 3, 4, 5 months down the road, I find out that, like, there's all this stuff that just doesn't work. It would have been so much more difficult to find that.
So thanks for the question, Ben. I hope that helps. Our next question is from Jim Monroe, and he says, hi guys, as always, fabulous show. I went back and listened to an older episode, I can't remember which episode, where Rob was talking about a funnel to convert a mailing list to a group of customers who are interested enough to pay for early access. So I think Jim's talking about as I was going through the Drip process. Jim says, I'm not sure I understand this transition process. Can you elaborate on, number one, how to identify the best target customers from your list? Do they self-select? Number two, assuming the product is a minimum viable product, are you just having them pay via PayPal? I don't have any payment method set up. And number three, how do you go from asking if they would pay for the product to actually agreeing to drop money and get early access to what is probably not a complete product yet?
So I think there's a couple of different ways you can do this. If you're using something like MailChimp, and I assume that AWeber and Constant Contact have very similar mechanisms, but with MailChimp, you can actually see who is opening the emails and who, because they rate them with a star system to see kind of how engaged those people are.
You can do that in Drip too, I'll just note.
So you go in there and you take a look at those and you can essentially eyeball it. And that's how you select those people, because if people are skipping over your headlines and not even opening up the rest of the emails that you're sending to them, then chances are really good that those people are not your quote unquote best target customers on your list. In terms of targeting those people and trying to find out more information about them to kind of really see who is and is not a good fit, because if you talk to any of them in one-on-one, they're going to seem like a good fit. But what you can do is you can find those people who, according to the statistics, say, hey, this person is actually opening the emails, they're interested, send those people a survey of some kind and ask them some very specific questions. And you can almost cross-section the people who are on your list to find out what criteria they match. How are these people similar to these other people over here? What are the differences between them? So maybe one person runs Windows, another person runs Linux. Maybe somebody does SaaS development, somebody else does desktop development. You know, there's a lot of different ways you can kind of cross-section them. And once you figure that out, you map those back to essentially figure out who your ideal customer is. Who's going to be the best person and the most likely to pay for your product? Those are the people that you want to go after, and those are the ones you want to ask, hey, would you pay money for this right here? Whether the product is complete or not, if you're actually solving their problem, those are the ones you want to try and get to pay for it.
So when I was working with the launch list for Drip, I really had two lists. I had this list of about 17 people who I knew in some form or fashion had committed to at least trying Drip out, and they were willing to pay for it. And those people I had communicated with individually, one-on-one, and each one of them I onboarded manually. I told them they would have to pay for it eventually, the price would be X, and I named a specific price, but told them that they could try it as long as they needed without paying until they got value out of it. Then I had this launch list of 3,500 people by the end. And that launch list is more something like Mike said, you have to start looking into and start trying to see patterns. Opens is, you know, one good metric to be able to see how people are interacting with your stuff. The other thing I did is I emailed a survey that we discussed in an episode, you know, it was around the 130s or 140s, where I called it a customer development survey. It essentially asked what their biggest pain points are, what they were hoping Drip was going to solve for them. Now, anyone who responded to that instantly becomes a much more interested party to me. And I think around that time, I had somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 on the list, and I got just under 200 responses. So that was a nice chunk. And then from there, based on the responses, I could sort even further and actually have real data individually. And I asked them for their email in the survey email. It was just a Google spreadsheet with a Google form over it. And so it was very simple to set up. Now that I had their email again, I could then map it to individual people. And I started talking to those people one-on-one as needed. And the people with whom Drip was going to have the most resonance based on what we built, those are the folks that I contacted sooner. And by the time I contacted them, I was already through 3 or 4 months of early access with these other 17 people. And so I did ask for a credit card up front. And at that point, I did have like a 21 or a 30-day trial by the time I got down the line with the bigger list. Jim, I appreciate you writing in, and I hope that's helpful. Our next question is from Margot Capax, and she says, "Hi, Rob and Mike. I've been a longtime listener of your podcast, and you've motivated me to bootstrap my own businesses. It's more than motivation. I've been taking little bits and pieces from you every week. Thanks for that. I'm writing because I've started to work on having someone produce content for my sites, and most important, an email newsletter. What is your favorite newsletter tool to handle email newsletters from start to finish? Over the last 24 months, I've seen so many businesses that offer this service, and I'm unclear which is better than another and why. What is your criteria for choosing a tool? Is MailChimp still the best? Which is your favorite and why? Thanks for everything, Margot."
I'll tell you what I use. I use a combination of MailChimp and Drip. And there's two reasons for that. One is because MailChimp was around long before Drip ever was. So I needed a newsletter tool. And essentially, MailChimp fit the bill very, very well. They give you a couple thousand email subscribers up front for no cost. If you want to get rid of their logos and stuff, you have to start paying it around the 500 mark. But even then, once you start paying, it's only, I think their pricing starts at like $10 or $15 a month or something like that. It's it's fairly inexpensive. The problem that I think that I see with MailChimp is that they don't necessarily give you the fancy things to put stuff on your website to drive people into that list. And that's partly why I use a combination of Drip and MailChimp. I'll say the line is starting to get blurred, but obviously Rob is going to kind of going in a different direction than MailChimp with its marketing automation. So I think that the two of them serve, I'll say, different purposes. And obviously there's different price points there as well. Some of the stuff that I do in Drip, I actually take those and hand them off over into MailChimp. And then there's other things where I just leave them in Drip and depends on what I'm doing and which of my lists that I'm working with. But I do use a combination of the both. I don't think that there's a best one out there. There's no best one. It's really which one meets your needs and which one's simple to use. I mean, you may very well start off using one particular product because it's easy to get into, but then as you use it more and more, you start to find that there's limitations around it and you just can't use it for everything. So for example, very early on, one of Drip's limitations was that you couldn't really put in any sort of template, and then that got added in. So over time, a lot of these, the downsides and the cons of going with a particular piece of software can go away unless you've gone back and reevaluated them. Probably not going to see those. So for example, if I were to look at AWeber today, there are probably things in there that I didn't know that they could do, or they added in there that I never noticed before because I'm just not a customer of theirs. So your needs change over time, the tools change over time, and what's best for you today may not be the best for you in 2 or 3 years. That said, you can sort of end up with a little bit of vendor lock-in just because you get onto a tool and you're there for so long. You've got all these processes and procedures in place for using that tool. It's integrated into all your different websites and applications. And then it can be hard to get out of that because it takes so much engineering effort to walk away and use something else, even if it is a better tool for you at that time. I would say that especially if you're early on, pick one that's easy to get started with and just understand that your needs very well may change and the tool may not do what you want it to do later on. And that's just life. I mean, every single tool is like that, whether it's email newsletter or whether it's a CRM package or a database, it doesn't matter. I mean, all your needs change, products change.
Yeah, I think if you're just getting started and you're going to be building a list probably fairly slowly and you just want to send a few broadcast emails, I would go with MailChimp because it's free to 2,000 subscribers. It's perfectly fine for sending broadcast emails. It really works for beginners. And I think don't waste time paying for a tool for 6 months while you kind of figure this out and build your list slowly. I do think that MailChimp, it is limited. You may hit a point where you want to do more exotic stuff with your list. And if you even getting autoresponders going is kind of a fiasco with MailChimp. The UI is not clear. There are just some issues there. So that's where you look at a tool like a Drip or, you know, AWeber's UI is not great either. But there's like Vero and customer.io and companies like that that are doing some other things and help you send autoresponders. And the UI is much easier to use. We all have more advanced automation stuff. But if you never get there, then MailChimp could certainly service your needs well for quite some time. Our next question is from Boris, and he says, I've developed a SaaS app. It's skyfeedback.com. It allows businesses and customers to communicate instantly and privately via SMS. I just launched about a month ago. I ran a Google AdWords campaign, and so far no customers, except it was only used during a church conference, and it worked great. I have a question. What is the strategy to advertise something that businesses are not searching for? I find that SMS customer feedback is something people do not search for, and I feel like this service has to be explained and sold through a sales agent. Am I correct in that assumption? Thanks for your advice, Boris.
It would seem to me that something like a SMS customer feedback mechanism, you know, software service, is probably going to be something where you can't justifiably charge a heck of a lot of money for it. It seems like it would be a relatively low price point. By low, I mean less than, you know, $30, $40, $50 a month or possibly a year. It kind of depends on what customer segment you're going after and why it is that they're using the service. What problem is it that they're actually solving? So your example of using it for a church conference and it worked great, it seems to me like the price point for something like that may be either free or something that maybe they pay $10 for it. That's not something that you're going to be able to use sales agents for. I mean, you're not going to have a sales rep come in and start making all these cold calls and trying to sell it for $10 a pop or $20 a pop. It's just not going to work, especially if it's a one-time fee. So I think that you need to do a little bit more digging and find out who is actually having these problems and dig a little further than that to figure out what is the value of getting answers to those things. Why do they want that feedback? Is this the only way to do it? Because I think what you'll find is that, for example, on a church conference or any given conference, for example, the way to get feedback is one is to send them an email and point them to a Google form, which is great. What does this SMS tool have over that? What are the advantages of using your mechanism versus something like that? And really try to position yourself against them and figure out whether this is even viable. Because from my standpoint, I'm looking at it saying, well, if I were to use this at a conference, I don't know as a SMS message out to people is really the most effective way to get information back from people. Because you can send it out to a bunch of people, you're not going to get it back in a real formatted mechanism, and you're going to be limited in the number of characters that people are willing to type on their phones. So those are the things that kind of come to mind. And I know that that's not a direct answer on it, but it seems to me like customer development around the actual problem itself is really where you need to go with this.
Yeah, I'd agree with Mike. This feels a little bit like a solution in search of a problem. That's not ideal now that you've launched, but it's not the end of the world, and you have to go find people who are having this problem now and niche it down. That's what I would start with, because your homepage says this is for businesses and customers to communicate, and that is just way too broad. So if it's conferences or conference organizers that are going to put this on, or if it's churches themselves, or if it's meetup groups, or if it's SaaS apps, you know, you figure out who needs this, where this really is a pain and this really improves their experience, find those people. Yeah, you're not going to be able to advertise to them because they're not looking for it, but once you find who they are, then you know where they are, right? You can look on LinkedIn groups. You can find them on Facebook and post ads there. You can post ads through something like buy sell ads. Once you find out what type of sites they frequent, you can go directly to trade sites and buy ads there. You can go to trade shows. I mean, there's all these ways to do it, but you have to know who your customer is. It is a big advantage if your customer is actually searching for the thing you offer in a generic way, and you can just do SEO or do AdWords and get to the top of Google and get clicks. But in your case, that's not the case, and a lot of businesses don't have that. And instead, they have to target a market rather than targeting the customer as they're searching for it.
Something like this, it might be best to kind of figure out who your ideal customer for it would be. And one that kind of pops into my head would be radio stations. And for something like that, you could presumably use a sales rep of some kind, because it would be easy to track down radio stations and find somebody in there. But as people are talking on the radio, they've got this giant audience of people that they're talking to, and they could ask them stuff. They could poll them for information, or so they can run contests like very, very quickly using this type of tool. But you would have to explain it to them, the benefits, and you know, maybe you put a working prototype in front of them and let them use it for a month or a couple of weeks or whatever, and teach them. You would have to onboard them. But that seems to me like that might be a better fit, and that kind of goes towards a profile where you've got this one business to many customers relationship. It might also work for companies like Dunkin' Donuts, where they've got a coffee shop on every corner and they want to send an SMS message to people. Maybe it integrates with geolocation, maybe not. But those are some things to think about. I mean, you need to find out who's actually going to use this and what problems they're trying to solve.
So I hope that helps you out, Boris. Our last question today comes from Mark Stevens, and he says, "Hi guys, I was interested in your comments on fog bugs. I think I probably signed up for it at the same business software conference as Rob. I wondered if you could expand on what you think it now lacks and what newer tools are offering."
I think for me, there's a couple of things that I'd say fog bug lacks. And the first one is on the service desk side. So using fog bugs as a customer support mechanism is passable. It does work. I wouldn't say that it's the best tool in the world for it. So it's just not as nice as I would like it to be from a customer perspective. I can't really integrate a widget onto my website or into my SaaS app and allow people to interact with that and essentially talk directly back to fog bugs. Now, they have APIs. I could engineer something, but I don't want to have to. I mean, I'm already paying for their software. I don't want to have to pay for this add-on as well. And I would have to engineer it probably from scratch. A couple other things is their Kiln integration, I think, is pretty good, but I would also like to see something where you can get, you can either subscribe to or get notifications of some kind. Maybe they're webhooks or something along those lines for when check-ins happen. For example, I mean, I have a bunch of people working on things. I actually use Bitbucket in some cases because I want an email notification whenever somebody checks something in. And I want to see information about that check-in, who did it, which repository it went into, and those kinds of things. So those types of things, I think, are very, very helpful. And I think that they could take those things there. I'm not about to switch just for the sole reason of getting some of those things, because then I lose all the history and I lose a lot of other stuff as well.
Yeah, I have several in mind as well. We use Fogbugs a lot. I use it for both driving development, like for product management, as well as for customer support. And there's a few things that I found that are just limitations these days. One is that there's no mobile app, and that really the mobile web interface is terrible. And so I often check email on my phone, and whenever I have a Fogbugs issue, I'm kind of screwed because I can click through and I can kind of read the issue, but then to try to do anything with it is a pain. And I know that if someone built a really nice web app, I'm sure Zendesk or Desk or Snappy or somebody has a good mobile app and makes this actually, you know, usable. Another thing is I would love to be able to, and I don't know if anybody does this one, but I've thought of this a lot. I get the issue in my queue, in my email, and to be able to reply to it and actually reply, have something appended, and then assign it to someone would be amazing via email, because then I could do it all within my, you know, my Gmail app on my phone. That's something I found just to be a limitation, is that when I'm on mobile, it's kind of a fiasco. Another thing is it is pricey compared to other solutions. You know, check out a solution like Snappy at besnappy.com. That's from Ian Landsman at Userscape. And I think they're, what are they, about 10 bucks a user, 15 bucks a user? So quite a bit cheaper than Fogbugs, about half the price. And a lot of the other help desk systems are similarly less expensive. I find that not having a knowledge base built in is kind of a pain, because I would love to be able to resolve an issue and then just move it into a knowledge base article, kind of beef up my response and migrate that in to have a searchable knowledge base. But instead, I have a third-party knowledge base that I'm using, and we have to migrate stuff manually over there. The UI of Fogbugs, I think, is out of date. It's kind of slow. It's kind of Ajax-y, but it was built really, 10 years ago, and they added Ajax onto it. So it's just not as usable, not as fast as a modern, like a more modern system would be. And there's a couple other things, mostly around CRM stuff. Like, we use it for support. I would love to be able to attach an email to an issue, so that oftentimes five people will request a feature, and I'm just adding them manually into the issue itself, and then I go and manually email each of them. But I know there are systems where if they request a feature, you add them into a notification list, and when that thing is resolved, then they all get emailed, and it says, this has been built, and it's done per your request, right? So it's a more of an automated process. It's more strongly typed. And also, really, in terms of CRM-type stuff, unless I see someone's name and recognize it, I have no concept when I get a new support request. All I see is an email and a name. And so I don't know, like, is this person a customer? What plan are they on? How long have they been a customer? How many campaigns do they have? How have they been using our app? All of that stuff. And I know that there are apps that'll integrate with it. They give you an easy API, and I could pipe some of my, you know, customer data in to make it just give me a bit more of an intelligent view of who I'm actually supporting and what they mean to my business. So those are actually, four or five things, mostly off the top of my head. I would guess there are systems out there that are doing most of the things I've said. But, you know, since we use Fogbugs, I don't really have a recommendation. But surely if you have one, would be good to see it in the comments for this episode 190.
Well, I think that about wraps us up for the day. If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or email it to us at questions@startupsforthestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups, or by RSS at startupsforthestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.